Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the pub where friends get together for a pint and a discussion about our favorite RPGs. Tonight is a special Know Your Developer episode. Instead of going through the hours of research, the subject was kind enough to send us their CEO and game director. I'd like to welcome to the show Ben from Snowcastle Games.
Hi, David. Thank you. Quite excited to be here.
Great to have the information straight from the horse's mouth. No Wikipedia search in and source review, and it's great. I could just ask you the straight up questions. And
yeah, I'll try to make as much sense as possible.
Sounds great. Yeah, it's always fun talking to people who make RPGs and get a background look at all the rough and the tough work that goes into making the games that we enjoy. So
yeah,
we're glad to have you.
Yep.
So Snowcastle created Earthlock. It's an RPG that released on the Switch a little over a month ago, on all major platforms actually, not just the Switch. And so we're gonna go over. I've got a few questions about how the process worked and things about behind the scenes stuff. But before we start, on the show we always talk about what we're drinking at the pub. But unfortunately, it's about 11 a.m. my time, and Ben's still at work over in Norway. So technically, it's neither of us are drinking. But what I'll do, I'll just change up the question a bit. Maybe just ask him. I've always been trying to plan a trip to Europe, and Norway is one of the countries that I'd like to visit. And I guess that is, if there's a beer out there that I should get if I manage to make my way up there, is there anything that I can't leave Norway without trying?
Yeah, there's recently been a lot of microbreweries. There used to be just like two major breweries in Norway, and then we imported a lot of Belgian beer. But there's one particular that's quite famous and rather expensive, but also really tasty, and it's called the Naked Eye Island, Nøgne Ø, in Norwegian. And it comes in quite large bottles and is very good. So definitely, if you come here, you should try the Naked Island.
Sounds great. I gotta get out there eventually. Europe is basically where all the best beer is, and that's my opinion, maybe kind of the home of where beer started. So
yep,
that's where I want to get out. So one day, I gotta save up my money.
Yeah, you can get a Interrail ticket, so you can just go by train. You have one train ticket that lasts for a month, for example, and you can just go all over Europe.
That's good.
Yep.
Alrighty, so maybe before we get into the background stuff, maybe if you just want to let the listeners know just what Earthlock is, and maybe just give us a quick pitch of why we should be playing it.
Yeah, Earthlock is a RPG inspired by the classic 3D RPGs of the 90s, PlayStation 2 era. We tried to create the same feeling that we remembered having while playing that those games back then, except in a new way or in a new console. We also tried to add some new takes on, for example, turn-based combat and character progression. So, we have a little island base where you can grow spuds and plants and fruits, and you're equipped with a spud gun, so there's your ammunition.
That's great. Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite parts of Earthlock was the kind of like your sanctuary. Yeah. Where you can...
It's nice to get away from the evil combat occasionally and just chill out.
That's right. Get a little quick farming simulator in to rebuild your weapon stock.
And yeah.
I'm just curious about how Snowcastle Games began and how the dev team ended up together.
Yeah, we started Snowcastle back in 2009. I think we were like four people back then. Eric, my partner, and Fritz, the art director, and the programmer, who's no longer with us. And then we did lots of flash games for a Norwegian television company to start with. And then we didn't have any funds, So we had to do some work for hire, and then slowly we managed to build a team. And we're now 11 people here in Oslo, and got another three external people. And a lot of them really knows how to make games, actually, all of them by now. So it's been a long, it's been 9 years. Oh my God. I just looked at, oh wow. Yeah. So, yeah. that's
how I get that feeling every day.
Yeah.
looking at the calendar going, is it really 2018?
Yeah. And, making Earthlock, took 5 years and we didn't have any income. So we had to, get money from friends, fools, and family, and some the odd investor, and just scrape by with a little fund, as little fund as possible. Also, the Norwegian government has some really nice funds for films and computer games, so we managed to tap into that as well. And we had a Kickstarter, so all of that enabled us to get the game out in 5 years. That was in 2016. And then we launched the game on Switch just recently. So after we launched the game first on Xbox and PlayStation and Steam, we spent a few months working on Earthlock 2, the next game in the same universe. And then we had this growing feeling that the game wasn't quite where we wanted it to be. And so we stopped making Earthlock 2 and then went back to Earthlock 1. And we said, okay, so there's a Switch coming out and we should probably get it out on that platform as well. And what will it take to make the game like how it should be with everything that we had to cut during the initial production and from the feedback we got from the community and stuff. And so we budgeted another 7-8 months. And then 13 months later, we were done. but now the game is where we want it to be. It feels more fleshed out, more whole, more fun. So that's good.
That's great. So on our show, what we usually do is go back and look at our favorite RPGs, but we usually start with the people that made them. So as the game director, you're our perfect starting off point. I was wondering if you could maybe just give us a little bit of history on some of the work that you've worked on and maybe some of your influences and inspiration.
Yeah, Earthlock is our second game. The first one was called Hogworld. It was a small adventure game for kids on iOS. We did back in 2011. We got some really nice reviews on that game. I think Apple put us on the best of 2000 something list for Christmas. And we didn't make much money at all.
I've heard that about mobile games.
Yeah, and we didn't want to do free-to-play or we couldn't put ads in the game. We wanted to make a premium game, and that was really hard to sell. But the first story told in the Earthlock universe, because the character in Hogworld was a little hog bunny mix of a rabbit and a hog. Called Nart, and he's a mage in Earthlock. So he stayed alive through that game and into the next one, and likely into the next one.
That's good. It's all canon, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, prior to that, I didn't work on making games, but I worked with analyzing games at a studio called, or a company called Game Explorer, where we made a database with computer games and gameplay elements in them, and we also created two books in 2006 and 2007 called Book of Games Volume 1 and Volume 2. Nice books, didn't sell much. That's me.
Fritz Olsen is the art director. I guess he was one of the main people in that kind of gave the feel and look of Earthlock.
Oh yeah, Fritz, the art and feel of Earthlock is very much due to Fritz. He's an extremely talented artist. He came on board back in when I had Game Explorer, and he was, I think, 16 years old. He came in as a tester who tested video games and answered all the questions about gameplay. And then he showed me his drawings, and he was just back then super talented, but a bit rough in the edges. And then I suggested he should go to some awesome game development school, and he did. And then some years later, in 2009, he came back, just when I started Snowcastle. So that was perfect timing.
Oh, perfect timing.
Yeah. And then we got a few senior developers. I was lucky enough to get a phone call in December a few years back when we were really pushing the finances, or it was really tough on the finances. And I got a call from a very talented and nice guy called Thomas, who was married to a Norwegian woman, but he was living in Scotland and been working at a company called Rockstar for 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
As a programmer and game designer. And I was like, well, yes, I got a job for you. I just need to find some money first. He's been super with all that, with those 10 years of experience from a big company. He managed to level up pretty much everybody in the company over the next year. And then we got several other people now also with experience, and some new ones who came in as interns and then afterwards became junior designers. So a mix.
That's great. And I noticed the composer for Earthlock is a fellow Canadian.
Oh, yeah. Aiko. She is a unique, rare talent. A friend of Fritz, I think, from his university days. She plays, I think, 32 instruments and just super multi-talented, and sings as well. And she does typically composes the music and then records each instrument by herself into like this whole orchestra. So yeah, she's been a super fine, and she's been with us from the early days when we made Hogworld. She made beautiful music for that game and continued making music for Earthlock.
Yeah, it's good that she's a friend of the art director.
Yeah.
Because there's obviously could be some collaboration there if she's looking for kind of direction or inspiration, I suppose, then it's good to know to be the buddy of the art director of the game.
Yeah. And also it's nice every time we go to Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, she tend to come down and help us man the booth and hang out. So even though we're on the other side of the planet, we can still see each other from time to time.
That's great.
Yep.
So maybe we'll start getting into the nitty-gritty of the process. And I was going to ask you about, you were talking about how difficult it is for when you're in game design, finding funding and keeping things afloat.
Yeah.
And you had decided to go through Kickstarter for a portion of the money anyway. I was wondering if you could give me some kind of like a bit of insight on how like the kind of the decision process behind like using Kickstarter as a platform. And
yeah, we back in, what was that, 2013, we had made a prototype of the game. We showed it at PAX West in Seattle, got really good response, and then we went on Steam Greenlight and got greenlit in 14 days, and we got pretty cocky. At the same time, we were also really low on funds, so it was like, okay, I didn't quite think it was within our reach, but with all this positivity, let's try Kickstarter. That might just save us. And so we started a Kickstarter in mid-November, which is epic bad timing. You don't do Kickstarter in just around Thanksgiving and the Christmas holiday. People are thinking about that. So, so
budgets are tight for everyone.
Oh, yeah. So halfway through that one, we just stopped it and said, okay, we're going to regroup and do another one in March. We did some more homework and launched a new campaign in March, and that went really well. So we got $178,000, and that back then seemed like a lot of money that would bring us really close to completing the game. Now in hindsight, I can see that fund is less than 10% of the actual cost of the development. So yeah, it's enormously expensive having 10 people or 15 people work full time for a whole year with offices and everything. But we got the game out, and we also have, with the Kickstarter money, you also get a Kickstarter crowd of very friendly people, for some Kickstarters, that is. And I think the ruler is that you need to keep your backers informed of what you do. And if you do that, they seem to be really nice and helpful and less of the angry sort. I have looked at a few other Kickstarter campaigns, not of ours, and seen that they can go really sour if you don't do your crowdfunding work properly.
Yeah, well, it's you can see like there's I know like some of the people on our site have funded different Kickstarter projects, and they don't always work out either.
No,
so that's part of it too. Is I think the some people can be a little wary of going on Kickstarter just because of the risk involved. Of
yeah, but that's the point with Kickstarter, because otherwise a lot of those projects would never happen. Like for us, for example, when we came to March that year in 2014, we were really at the edge of any finance, any finances we had, and I couldn't wrestle out more private funding. We were likely to get a grant from the Norwegian government, but only if we could get some more money. And so I was at that point that if the Kickstarter failed, the company would be bankrupt. And that was 2014. I already put 5 years of my life in the company and all my savings. So that was stressful. But the Kickstarter was successful, and we got the funds from Kickstarter and topped up with the funds from the government. So that was a double win.
That's very interesting to me, because I even know people who kind of think, well, you know, the Kickstarter, I don't think they realize how much, like, the Kickstarter is only a portion. Like, I think some people kind of look at it and think, like, that's, well, you got your funding, where's the games, you know, and not understanding. Like, when you said it was less than 10% of the total cost, like, I was like, wow, that's...
Yeah, and I, at that point, I worked with games for 5 years, and I still underestimated how expensive it would be to complete the game the first time, and then we had to complete it again for the second time. Problem with games is that you can't design it on paper. You need to play and test it. And if it isn't fun, the game isn't done. You need to go back and redo it. And so it's really hard to plan properly. But with Kickstarter, I think that's what's very important for people to remember, is when you back someone on Kickstarter, you're backing them. You're not buying their game. You're backing them. It's a massive difference.
Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction, really.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the feeling I think most people go in with, is that you're buying the game, and it's like, no, you're backing them, you're not buying it.
You're buying their dream.
That's right. It's very important. That kind of segues into like the community. Like when you go on Kickstarter, you're kind of selling an idea to backers. Did you feel any kind of pressure or like guidance of like the communities pushing in one direction, and maybe like did you feel any kind of that, or was it more just you know, just a bunch of people saying, you know, rah rah, let's get the game?
Yeah, quite a bit of impatience, of course. It's like, I backed the game, why isn't it done yet? You promised it within a year, and it's now been 3 years. fortunately, we had informed people regularly, like, okay, so we're done this, this is delayed, we're trying to get this done. And just communicating at least like once every one or two months. Mm-hmm. And so even though some people were getting really impatient, they were losing their patience, and that was a big difference. But for the most part, we've gotten lots of like constructive ideas from the community, but no one like demanding that we do this or that, or we couldn't do this or that. And I think that's positive. I mean, getting suggestions and creativity from your community is super awesome, but having people tell you what to do is less ideal.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I've noticed. I wasn't sure if it was prevalent in Kickstarter is that a lot of the indies, there's the nostalgia factor kind of comes into play with a lot of indie developers, where people kind of, they have an idea of what they used to play and kind of want something like that. And I wonder how much the developers, when they're making games, kind of wrestle with that nostalgia versus the new thing that they're trying to...
That's really hard. For example, we had a long, long debate on having save points, save statues, instead of just saving anywhere, because saving anywhere is what people are used to now. But save statues are... they have a gameplay feature, because... If you can only save at the start of a dungeon, and then you have to go through the dungeon and defeat the boss, it's not just the boss, it's like preserving your resources and getting through to the boss is also part of the whole beating the boss gameplay. And so we chose that, and that makes the game really difficult for people like me who have children to play for 10 minutes and then put down, because you can't save. So there's some pros and cons to that. At the same time, I think we succeeded in creating that old feeling, that good old school feeling, without being completely old school. I got a lot of people writing to us, telling us that we managed to give them exactly that feeling they had when they were playing games in the 90s, except it looks modern and plays on their current console. For those people, I think we achieved what we set out to do. And then we've had people who... don't get why we have save statues, because they're young, they never played a game with save statues. And it's just, for them, it's just like, oh, it's so lame, why can't I just save when I want to? I don't think you can make a game that pleases everybody.
No, that makes sense. We've actually had, even at our site, staff will be debating the pros and cons of different design choices and that sort of thing. Like you said, it's funny with the save feature, because you know, one person could say, well, the save statues are there because they couldn't figure out how to save anywhere. And it's like, I don't know if that's why, like,
nah.
But I totally get the design factor of it, because like you said, you could be in a dungeon and you could get to the boss and save in front of the boss and then just keep playing the boss over and over till you beat them, as opposed to it being like a full, like, you go in and, like you said, sit resources and that, so saving resources. And
so
it makes sense.
It is a different challenge, but it's also, of course, if you, like when we first launched the game and there were some bugs that caused it to crash, then save statues are extremely annoying. I think we're going to seriously consider our saving features for our next game. The point is also, is it fun? That's like the most important question I think a game designer needs to ask him or herself when making a game. This thing I'm doing, or this feature I'm adding to the game, is it fun? And yes, I think, for example, as we're talking about save statues, they're fun in terms of getting that challenge of beating a dungeon and a boss. But they're not fun when you have 30 minutes to play, and or 10 minutes to play, or 20 minutes to play, and you can't save, and you got to leave, and then you have to replay it. Because replaying the same thing all over again isn't fun. So,
yeah, that kind of goes into another debate we were having too, of difficulty versus accessibility.
Yeah, and
I personally lean on the difficulty.
Yeah, and that's what we do too. That's, I mean, Thomas, our lead game designer, he is super into hardcore, self brutalizing games like Bloodborne and. Stuff like that, and he really wants the hardest challenges, and if you look at the art for Earthlock, it looks like a quite cute, like child friendly game, And especially with, the first time we launched the game, some of the bosses were really brutal. If you didn't figure out how to use the right tactics, he would just annihilate you.
Okay. So I'm guessing, I didn't play the first version of it, but I'm guessing then the, because I know in this, like in on the Switch, if you're defeated by the boss, when you reappear at the save statue, the I can't remember his name. The frog boy.
Yeah, frog boy.
Yeah, frog boy. Kind of gives you the hint of maybe you should have done this.
Yes, this is stuff that we added based on community responses. Because it's like for some people, it's highly frustrating if you guide them. They don't want an arrow telling you where to go. They don't want you to help them. They want to figure it out themselves. And then on the other side, you have people who get super frustrated if there isn't an arrow that they can follow. They want to be like guided through the game. And so adding Frog Boy was a way to help those who felt like they needed some extra help without forcing it on those who didn't want it. Because you can choose not to talk to him and just fight the boss again. So you can get the hints or you can avoid getting the hints.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like you said, it's hard to... Everybody's got their way of playing, so it's trying to find ways to please everyone. I guess it's not easy.
Yep.
So you were saying when it first released, I guess there were some features that you felt were like when you first released Earthlock at the when the Kickstarter was done. At the time, did you feel like the final product was what?
Oh yeah, you envisioned? Yeah. We were super happy. We were super proud, and just having completed the game and it was playable, and we thought it was challenging, which is always something you should worry about. If you, as a developer, find the game challenging, the players will find it super challenging. We were super happy. We had made a lot of cuts, and because we've been working with this for so long, like 5 years, we knew all the characters by heart and what they like, where they came from, and what they were doing, and why they were doing it. So when we cut out parts of the game that we couldn't, didn't have time to put in there. We cut out parts of the story that for people who didn't know all that we knew really made it hard for them to understand what was going on or follow the main narrative, the plot holes that made stuff not make sense. The female protagonist, Ive, came out as rather spoiled and not very nice when she's a really nice person. So one of the first things we did was rewrite the dialogue and her behavior in the first 5-10 minutes of the game to show her as she is. And that helped a lot. But then also there was like places where we simply hadn't had time to make all the things we wanted. So there wasn't any side quests and less interactivity in general. And so that was what we spent the last 13 months doing, was like adding side quests and mini games and silly stuff. Yeah, you can find some seeds that you can plant, and then there will grow a kitten tree that would spawn small kittens that you'll just jump around and do nothing but look cute. So and I think that's important to have that time for polish and add those silly, fluffy, funny things.
Yeah, it's a lot of times it's the small details that can really kind of push a game.
Yeah,
from enjoying it, not the, you know, like people loving like almost not Easter eggs, but kind of just like the fine details, like you said.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll segue into the next. I was curious, as an independent studio, I know it's very difficult to kind of get your name out, get the word out. I'm assuming that in the RPG genre, it's even that much more difficult.
Yeah, we were lucky because we did the Kickstarter before it was super, super hard to do Kickstarter. And so we got 5,000 backers, and that definitely helped us get some attention. But as a no-name indie studio without any previous games, it's really hard to get attention from the games press, media, and publishers and investors. So yeah, you kind of have to prove yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you if, then once you publish the game and you're like, okay, now I'm finally going to earn money, then you realize that you're not alone. There's a lot of other indie developers out there. So the year we launched on Steam, there was 4,207 new games on Steam. Like,
oh, and
that was those games on that was published in 2016 was 38% of the total number of games on Steam that year. And then the next year, in 2017, there was almost double the amount of published games. So publishing a game on Steam is becoming more like making your own website and hoping to get lots of traffic for it. Mm-hmm. what typically happens, and we saw that happening on the iOS market back in 2011, and that is prices drops. And then all of a sudden it gets really hard to make good games and recoup your investment in the development. At the same time, we've also been compared to visually to AAA studios and AAA games. And then because we don't have, for example, voiceover, some have been like, oh, but it's a trashy game because it doesn't have voiceover. And voicing our game would cost hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard, but at the same time, it's also fun because it's you're working in an industry that changes and it's growing and there's so much happening. And the one of the best parts of being in the indie game industry is that all the other indies are your competitors in one way, but they all seem to be really friendly and helpful and share information and help each other. So we just have to learn quickly.
Yeah, well, in a way, other indie success actually could spawn success for you. Like, you know, if someone who's kind of been an Atlus or Square Enix player, and then they you know are introduced to a good indie game, and then maybe come to that realization that hey, maybe there are other indie games that are good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see how there'd be a little bit of camaraderie in the indie scene.
Yeah. Yeah, back when we were publishing Earthhawk for Xbox, we had to get it through all these age rating certifications, and the Australian one was specifically difficult because they wouldn't take anything digitally. We would have to send them physical discs and physical DVDs with the video. And at the same time, we were having a super tight deadline and they were doing some vacation time or something. So we had to get the disc to them from Norway to Australia in 2 days, which was, even with the most expensive courier, it was almost impossible. But fortunately, some really nice people from an indie studio called Five Live Studio, former Bullfrog guys, worked on a game called Syndicate back in the old days, and then made a similar game now called Satellite Rain. They were so friendly, so they helped us. I could just send them all the binaries and the video, and they would burn it on a CD and DVD and ship it across the street. So we made the deadline.
That's great.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. Awesome.
Yeah, that's a good. That's what networking can do for you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Making friends at those GDCs.
Exactly.
I guess that one of the things about Earthlock I wanted to just talk about a bit is I know in my experience with RPGs, a lot of the time to get the most enjoyment out of it is kind of when you've discovered the way the developer intended it to be played.
Yes.
I guess one of my examples would be like, I know in Radiant Historia, I just recently played that one, and I had never played a game with that, like the grid system.
Yeah.
So I wasn't particularly enjoying it until I kind of figured out, you know, the matching up people in squares and doing the combos and that sort of thing. And it kind of changed the whole experience for me. So I was wondering if there's anything that new players to Earthlock maybe should know that so that they, you know, they don't start it and maybe not quite getting it right away. If there's any kind of hints or direction maybe of just like the best way to experience it?
Yeah, I think trying out different things to figure out your play style. You can choose, each character has two stances, like Eamon has a spud gun where he can shoot ranged magic spuds, and he has a thief stance where he can steal stuff and use his dagger. But then you have a talent tree where you build your character, like the character progression. And you, if you choose to go for magic and ranged, then of course you will be much better at using your spud gun. And the same goes for the little hug bunny Nart. He can be have buffs and offensive magic, or he can be more defensive and healing magic. And it's quite interesting when you're fighting small critters that aren't that hard. If you are aggressive, you can get really quickly through the combat, but if you're playing more defensive, they can take a bit longer. So it really, really changed how you enjoy the game, or how fast-paced you feel it is, depending on your strategy. Also, you can get to places. So there's a little magic creature called an Imkin, which is a nasty spellcaster, and if you cost silence on that creature, he's really easy to take down. So yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing I noticed too is that there's a lot of focus on like the pairing system. It seems like a couple of the characters are more, it's like, because you've got the sharing of the special.
Yes. That was quite funny, because I'd find my playstyle through the quality assurance period, where we're just playing the game, trying to find bugs. And then one day I was looking over the shoulder of one of the other guys and looking at him playing. I was like, what? You're playing it all wrong. And he was like, but I'm totally beating it. I was like, yeah, okay. So trying out different friendships and their stances is quite interesting, because there's really so many different variations to setting up these six characters in two pairs. I'm not going to get too many spoilers.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. No, that's great. So I guess you kind of hinted at it early in the interview, but it sounded like what's next for you guys is a sequel to Earthlock?
Yeah, when we started the Kickstarter, we were already thinking about Earthlock as a game story world, a place that we would have to explore the everything over more than one game, because it was just such a big planet and so weird a planet. It's a planet that has stopped spinning around its own axis, so it's like one side is always facing the sun and one is always in perpetual darkness, and that creates a really weird world with big contrasts between light and dark and cold and warm, and no sunset, or well, like no time of day. You can't really tell what time of day it is because the sun's always there or not there. So the Kickstarter, we said we would make three games in this series, and we stuck to that. And it's super exciting, because there's so much stuff that we were thinking about while we made the first game that we couldn't do. And for the next game, we're going to explore much more telling or showing and letting you as a player interact with an environment where you can see the consequences of the tidal lock of the planet. So, like a city, how do you show that, or how does a city enable themselves to sleep at night and get this day-night cycle? How do they know what time it is? And so we've been looking at ways to deal with that. For example, in Norway, there's a little city in a deep, deep valley next to a power plant, hydro plant, that hardly sees any sun in October, November, December, January, and February. And in order to make life better for them, they have installed a big array of mirrors on top of the local mountain that reflects light into the city. And so one of those cities that are on the border of where it's light and dark could, for example, have a similar mirror array on a mountain or on a tower or something that would reflect light into the city. And then you can manually turn them if you want it to be dark at night and then get them back in or turn them back when you want it to be morning. And how would plants react? Plants will also, they like night and day cycle. They breathe air at night and produce oxygen in the sunshine. And so can we make plants that behave and do stuff to show you as a player that, oh, it's actually night now in a way. It's the 24-hour cycle is moving. So that's something we didn't get to do in the first game, and that's something that we're exploring in the next game, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, that's... and especially when you see the community reaction to something like Breath of the Wild, where the fine details of the environment are... Like, people are excited, or they do get into it. So that does sound like a very interesting way to play, yeah. You know?
And also, the first game we did as a homage to those awesome games that we grew up playing. The next game, we're doing a more contemporary game. So it's still going to be a role-playing game. We're going to have turn-based combat in one way or another. But apart from that, we're kind of free to do our own take on a contemporary role-playing game. So I can't say much more. We're still really, really early in the process. So nothing is really set in stone yet.
Well, it already sounds interesting. So we'll be watching for that. If you end up doing a Kickstarter for that, you're going to have to flip me an email.
Okay. It's a lot of work.
I can be on board. Yeah, I can be on board with that. But hopefully everything works out, so you don't need that this time around.
Yeah, I hope. It's fun doing a Kickstarter, but it's so hard. It's so hard. Yeah. It probably takes like 5 years of my life. So I'm not sure I'm going to do it again.
Well, I wish all the success on the sequel, and hopefully this helps get some people onto Earthlock now so that they can enjoy the game. Is there anything else you wanted to say about Earthlock? Or?
Well, if anyone plays Earthlock and have feedback, we're listening. You can send us tweets or emails or post on Steam forum and any other forum. Pretty much we lurk around and see what's written most places, and we try to reply to anything we can. So we really enjoy getting feedback, also the negative feedback if it's constructive and not just hatred.
Do you want to dare give your Twitter accounts?
Yeah, for Snowcastle? It's Snowcastle Games. It's just at Snowcastle Games, Facebook, Twitter, and Steam, and on we also have a Nintendo channel where we will be posting updates, little tidbits of background story from the Earthlock universe and other silly, interesting stuff. So we just got it started a few weeks ago. So you can follow us on your Switch as well.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Oh, and I guess we should tell everyone. So I imagine most people listening to our podcast probably have a Switch. And that's, for to me, RPGs, it's just the Switch is the perfect place. Because when I'm getting irritated at work and I need a break, then it's just flip out the Switch and do some grinding in an RPG. Yeah. But for anyone who doesn't own a Switch, Earthlock is available on PS4, Xbox, and Steam.
Yeah.
But I would recommend it on Switch.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It was like when we got the game on the Switch, it was like, oh, it feels like it has landed at home now. Having the game, holding it in my hands like that was really good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to me, the taking it with you is the big thing. Like, I know there's a lot of RPGs on 3DS and stuff, but it's just so much different when you're kind of getting the full HD in your hands.
Yeah.
Wherever you go. And then the other part of the Switch too that I enjoy is that, like you said, with the saving feature, like the save statues.
Yeah.
With the Switch, like if you're not, as long as you're not moving games, you can just put her in a sleep mode. And
yeah, that's really good with the Switch.
Yeah. So, yeah, I recommend if you got a Switch, then that's where you should get it. So.
Oh, also on probably closer to Christmas, we will be inviting people to a small community to help start checking out and playtesting the next game. And get feedback from them. So the idea is that over the next 2.5 years, we will be working with the community and trying out stuff and getting their feedback on a regular basis. So if you like Earthlock and want to help with the next game, then yeah, sign up for our mailing list on snowcastle.no.
Yeah, it's perfect. I know where I'll be emailing in a few minutes.
So. Cool.
No, that's great. Yeah, I wanted to thank you very much, Ben, for taking the time to have a chat with our podcast. And
thank you.
Helping lots of great insight into how difficult and how much work it is building the game. I know it's easy for on the gaming side of it to just kind of sit back and where's my game? So,
yep.
It's good. It's good to you know, empathize with the amount of work and appreciate it when it's ready and it's good to go. So
thank you.
And to just make sure everybody knows that you could follow us on Twitter. Our handle is The Thirsty Mage. We're also available on a subreddit if you'd like to engage in some discussion. The subreddit is just The Thirsty Mage. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. We'll have a special review episode for a certain 3DS game that will be coming out shortly. But until then, thanks again for listening to my interview with Ben from Snowcastle Games, and I'll see you at the next Thirsty Mage.